Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Well, hi, and welcome to another edition of Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. How's that for an opening? I want to thank you for joining us today, wherever you are. Hope you're having a good day and hope that we can add a little bit to your life and give you some things to think about today. And we have a person as our guest today, David Zimbeck, who has given me a lot to think about, and I hope that he will contribute to your thought processes as well. David, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's an honor being on here, and nice meeting you and everything.
Looking forward to it. Well, let's start like I tend to do a lot. You obviously grew up. Tell me a little bit about you as a child and kind of what you had going on growing up and where that led to, because you have quite an interesting life and you've done some very remarkable things, and let's talk about it. So I was just kind of wondering, what was it like being a kid for you and where did it go?
Well, actually I've had because I know we talked earlier and I've had a pretty diverse background. So people kind of get surprised when they see that I've done various things with moderate levels of success. And mostly, you know, I was always encouraged to be creative growing up. So, you know, my parents never really, you know, inhibited me. I'd gone to different schools, public, private schools, as well as homeschooling. I was a little disobedient, so I didn't really, I can't say I was like the model student or anything, but it's possible that that worked in my advantage, because what it also taught me was to think outside the box, you know, and to try to understand exactly what it is that we're being taught and why. And, you know, I also had a drive ever since I was younger to make the world a better place. That was even since I was like 10 years old. And my attitude was just, well, nobody else is doing it. Somebody's gotta clean all this shit up. So, you know, I just decided that I would try to do it. And so that's also something kind of kept me somewhat diverse in my careers. But at the same time, whenever I do something, I like to benchmark myself and do a really good job at it. So with that in mind, you know, when I left high school, I went straight into working, because I didn't want to waste any time. And I worked in the real estate sector as well as acting, and that was like my early work. Oh yeah, and I was also a chess player. So that was one thing that probably really helped me a lot as a kid, because I was considered one of the top chess players, or at least one of the top chess puzzle makers in the world. So what I did was I first learned how to play chess when I was like 11 or 12, and then after that, I knew I didn't want to play too competitively, even though I'd gotten my master title and master rank, and I could have played competitively, but I preferred the idea to express my work as an art form. So, because an art form kind of is a lasting thing. If you paint a picture, you know, and you put it on the wall, it's a lasting thing. But if you're competing all the time, they always say you're only as good as your last win, you know, and I didn't want to be like a dog chasing my tail, like chasing my own ego.
Yeah.
So essentially, I just wanted to benchmark myself, which I did, and I did really good work, and that's what I did as a teenager. And then as I got older, that helped me in a lot of my work because I was able to apply it to things. And I know you'll be able to appreciate this because it helps you visualize things. So I was able to visualize things in my head, you know, because when you're playing a game of chess, you're seeing it on the board, and you're essentially moving the pieces with your mind. Before you even place your hand on a piece, you have to figure out where they're going to go and what the possible things could happen in the future. So you calculate all that in your head. So it's very similar to what you do. And it's almost kind of like once you crack open your mind, you know, it never ends.
How do you get the ranking of chess master? How does that work? I understand the concept of the title, but how do you get that?
So what happens is you just play enough. I mean, when you play in tournaments or whatever, you end up playing against other players. And if you win, you gain points on your rating. And if you lose, you know, you lose points on your rating. So once you get a rating of over a certain number, then in America, we have unfortunately, we have a different rating system. So we're like one of the only countries that does, but there's two. There's basically the USCF and FIDE. So for United States Chess Federation, I'm like maybe 2400, somewhere around there. So that's, you know, that's my rating. And so that's well above master. I could have gotten Grandmaster, International Master titles, but for that I would have had to travel because there's more, because they play under the system of FIDE. So to get that, you know, I would have had to actually go to Europe, which actually I did for a little while, but I wasn't as focused on chess when I went there.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So, No, it's a good question because a lot of people think it's not like something you can just pull out of a hat and say, "Oh yeah, I'm a master at this." No, you actually have to earn it.
And well, I figured that was the case, but I was always just sort of curious as to how the ranking actually was achieved, and clearly you did a lot of it. And as you pointed out, you have to really use your mind because chess is really only as an end result on the board.
Well, there's something else too, which is unlike other games, like if you look at games like poker or other games, which granted do have a good amount of skill involved, there's also a great deal of luck. Whereas chess, there's no luck at all whatsoever. You know, you play a game of cards, you know, you need to get good cards. You play a game of Scrabble, you need to get good tiles. You play a game of chess, you just need to make good moves. And you don't even play the opponent, you play the board. Because the better you move is on the board, there's nothing your opponent can do. So it's really a game of pure skill. I mean, even you could even argue some sports that, well, I'd say sports are almost pure skill, pretty much for the most part, but there's still a little luck involved with, you know, you could miss a shot, a breeze in the wind could knock your golf ball off course, you know, something can happen, but in chess, there's no forces of nature that would interfere with your performance. So that's what makes it a good game to learn, especially, you know, for kids. There was that. And then when I was in, I traveled a little bit and I was in Los Angeles actually with my sister who was pursuing acting, which wasn't really my interest at the time. But since I had my family all had like a theater background, I was pretty much familiar with it, and she helped me get like an agent and stuff like that. So actually I was doing pretty good with that too. And I was booking like commercials and in some movies. I booked Pirates of the Caribbean 2, which is what I'm the most known for, where they flew me out to Bahamas and, you know, I was on the boat with Johnny Depp and Keira Knightley. And so, I mean, I guess it's coincidental, I happened to work in that as well. I was one of the pirates actually.
You're one of the pirates. Did you have a speaking part?
Yeah. No, but it was probably because of my audition. Cause when we did the audition, it was a little bit of improv. And so all the pirates who auditioned were older. Actually, it was one of the biggest auditions in LA, or I think at the time, cause it was maybe like 10,000 people that went out for it. And they only picked like 20 of us, you know? So, when we auditioned, there was all these older gentlemen who were, you know, look like pirates. And I'm probably 30 years younger than anybody auditioning. So I said, "Oh, there's no way I'm going to get this." And so I just didn't take it seriously, you know, but I did a little bit, you know, I mean, I walked, but I was, when I went for the audition, I was like, you know, "Yar, I'm a pirate. Argy barge, you have a pretty daughter." And I just kind of was just having fun. And I guess that they responded to that exuberance and thought it was funny. And that's what got me the role, actually. Interestingly enough, for other times I would audition. No, unfortunately. There was a possibility I might have ended up having a speaking role thrown at me. It happened to a couple of the core pirates. But what happened is there was a hurricane that hit. We were in Freeport, Bahamas, so there was a hurricane that hit. I think it was Hurricane Wilma at the time, and we ended up getting called home and flown home charter. So we only got about, like, I would say like a month then change maybe out in the Bahamas before we were flown home. But it was still an amazing experience.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, I got snubbed from the credits. I don't know if it was because of that or because we never properly managed our contract or whatever, but it's okay. That's part of life. It was still a great experience. And yeah, I mean, it was really fun. So, yeah, I mean, I think that those things definitely helped give me some experience out in the field of succeeding in various different professions. But like I said, because my focus was on making the world a better place, I never quite could, I guess you could say, put like my full passion or my heart into some of those ordeals. Actually, it was one of the reasons I left chess behind as well, which eventually we'll get to, you know, where I actually ended up making a name for myself, which was in Bitcoin. But that didn't come till later. I mean, I'd still worked some odd jobs. I'd worked on the oil rigs for a while, and I was doing about like 100-hour a week, you know, which is just crazy. We'd sleep like 4 hours a night and stuff like that. And then after that is when I got involved in Bitcoin. But I'll turn the floor over to you for a moment.
That's fine, actually. Well, even Black Jack Sparrow had ethics. So just saying.
Oh, all the pirates do.
Yeah.
They go by a different code. It's yeah.
Well,
I've always seen it as the most important code of ethics to go by is a moral compass, you know.
Right.
As if you have a true moral compass and one that's objective, because nowadays our modern society is a little bit they believe the morals are relativistic. Well, if I believe it's okay, it's okay. But that's just not how the world works. That's not how things truly are, because nothing is truly subjective. When you really boil it down to like the truth is in fact objective. So it doesn't really matter if 100% of the society agrees that, you know, killing people is a good thing. If they agree on it, it doesn't make it a good thing. It's still morally reprehensible. So I think that the key is having a good moral compass, and then from there. And I don't know. Maybe I just always had it. Maybe my parents just raised me well. I don't really know. I mean, I feel like a lot of it I kind of carved out on my own, because I saw so many things that bothered me, and I just said, I don't want a world like that. I want to make the world better somehow.
Well, here's a question, and, out of curiosity. Yeah. When you live your life, do you, like, at night or at some time during the day, you've done things and so on, do you go back and do self-analysis? Did I do that the best I can? What could I have improved on that? Was that a mistake? Do you do much analysis of what you do and think about that?
Yeah, constantly. Actually, one of the most important qualities a person can have is introspection. You know, very few people look inside. And
right.
One of the most critical things for me is I sit there and I say to myself, actually, to be honest, I don't know how some people can even manage their own lives if they've done awful things to others in their life. It's like, how can you wake up in the morning and look in front of the mirror and be really proud, you know, of that person? You know, it's like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It's like as if they have no sense of self, you know, and I don't know how that works. I don't know if maybe they're proud of what they do. I have no idea. But to me, it just seems like if you're introspective and you really look inside yourself, you're going to start caring a lot about, you know, your soul and how, you know, how pure and innocent, you know, how you can maintain your own innocence and stuff like that. I would think that those things would be very important.
That gets back to the moral compass concept again, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So I do believe that, and you know, introspection also has to do with casting away pride. Like if you make a mistake, you have to be completely honest with yourself about your mistake. It is actually, again, the thing about chess is, like, if you're playing chess, you know, it's ironic. You would think that strong players would have an ego, but actually they don't. Some do. Okay. Yeah. Some are pretty bad, but for the most part, to get to a certain point, you have to kind of humiliate yourself quite a lot, because you're going to lose a lot, you know, or you're going to sacrifice a lot. You're going to sacrifice a lot of time. You're going to change your ideas about what you think is strong and what you think is weak. There's going to be a great deal of humility that's going to be introduced to you. And if it hasn't been introduced to you, then clearly you're not working hard enough, you know, because once you get to the higher levels, you end up start realizing all the fantastic and beautiful possible things that could happen. And then even then, and that's only applying to chess, which is like an 8x8 little board. I mean, imagine life, which is like, you know, it's infinitely times, well, not infinite, it's almost endlessly more complicated. And what you could argue, a person's potential is literally limitless. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing really that we can't do. But it tends to be like pride which would get in the way. So one of the obvious advantages of being introspective is not being afraid of admitting a mistake, not being afraid of, you know, having you know, being a little upset with yourself over something, but of course, working towards making yourself better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and, I do. One of the things about chess is, of course, that in one sense, it's very unforgiving. You play, and if you make a mistake, you very well could lose. But the other side of that is, and that's why in part I asked the question about introspection, you can then go back and look at it and say, why did I lose, or what was the mistake, or why did I make that mistake, and what can I learn from that for the next time? And I think that's a really good subset of life. And it's something that I advocate. We've talked about it on this podcast before, and something that I think is extremely relevant is that it's important for us to look at what we do. It works better if we do it from the standpoint of a moral compass, but it is important for us individually to go back and look at what we do and what do we know and how can we best use our knowledge and where do we go from here?
Basically, like it'll help you get along better with other people as well. You know what I mean? Because if you're introspective, you know, and somebody points something out to you, you're not really going to be afraid of criticism. And sometimes I have, you know, issues with friends if they have a hard time accepting criticism, which usually happens when they carry a lot of guilt, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they've come back from war, they're just traumatized, and you know, maybe they can't even take the slightest shred of critique. And you can almost see it unfolding. It's not that it's personal. It's not like that they're upset with you. It's that they can't take more responsibility because they've had a hard time accepting the responsibility they've already had to take. You know what I mean? Which is all the more reason why you shouldn't give yourself any.
Right. I absolutely agree.
Don't want to be dragging that baggage around. You know what I mean?
I agree. And, you know, personally, I believe I'm my own worst critic, and I want to be, because I should be able to analyze and look at things. But at the same time, I never mind input from other people, because if I have such an ego that I can't listen to what other people say, then I don't ever really connect with them. Whereas if somebody is willing to be strong enough to say to me something about what I do, a podcast or whatever, and for me to then look at it and decide whether I agree with that or not, then I have a real problem with me.
Yeah, totally. It makes perfect sense.
So how did you go into programming and so on? You obviously did that. And of course, chess certainly gives you a mindset for that. But how did you then go into the whole world of programming and doing software stuff?
So the thing is that I learned when I was a little kid, I think my uncle taught me to make like mazes or something in QBasic. And I was like maybe 10, 11 years old. But that's about as far as my programming experience had. You know, I was just, you know, just playing around mostly. And I remember making some cool stuff. But for the most part, you know, I didn't really do much. I know in high school I did, I learned C and I think C++. But, you know, nothing serious. It wasn't until later when I was working on the oil rigs, and then I had some downtime. I actually switched jobs and was doing easements. And then I was always good with computers, because I was around computers, because I was doing things like editing and web design because I did some commercial production for a while and stuff like that. So I was familiar with, you know, very familiar with computers. Plus I did a lot of research. So from that, you know, I worked with them. And so I automated my job when I was there doing the easements, and because we were having to type up hundreds of legal contracts, which all essentially looked the same. So after I automated my job, I was able to do like a job which maybe had would have taken weeks, and I did it in a matter of a day or two. And actually, I got fired for it for working too efficiently. And then it was at that exact time where I'd already known about Bitcoin since it started. Essentially around maybe 2011. Yeah, I think it was when I knew about it. So maybe like a year after or so. And so I always knew about it, and I'd known about some of the stuff on the deep web because I knew that, you know, it was interesting because there were things on the deep web that weren't on the main web. For the most part, it took me a while to actually have it click, because when I'd first known about it, I didn't think of it as an investment vehicle. I just thought of it as like a very cool kind of decentralized banking system. But I never really saw how it would gain the traction or the. So when I saw it later, when I was out in North Dakota, it had clicked. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. This thing that used to be worth nothing is now actually quite valuable. At the time, it was maybe $100 or something like that, but you know, it was pretty good. And so I said, well, I'm not gonna miss out on any further. And I'd made an investment, and I remember making an investment in Litecoin or something, and I turned like $1,000 into like $50,000 within, I don't know, a week or two. It was crazy. So I held onto it a little too long, and then some of that like went back down, but I started to learn, you know, and I started to get involved in altcoins and in them, just, you know, for fun. And, but it wasn't my primary motive to see it as more just like an investment vehicle, which maybe I should have, cause I would have made a lot more money. But I was also kind of interested in what you could do with Bitcoin. See, cause the thing was, is you understand the concepts of it, you kind of understand that, well, first of all, it's decentralized because there's many, many different people who have a copy of the ledger, kind of like if everybody has a copy of the same movie, you know, you can't change a line in the movie without everybody disagreeing. You know, oh, hey, that's not what he really said. So if everybody has a copy of the bank ledger, it's basically immune to fraud, which is, it's humongously important. And furthermore, it makes it so that nobody could just take money out of thin air and produce it, which is way more than we can say for the Federal Reserve, because they're just printing money like crazy at their own will. So having something that's kind of like ownerless, that's immune to fraud and can theoretically replace modern banking is and is safe, and that nobody can freeze your account is awesome. That's amazing. But at the same time, I knew that politically, the governments are always going to be able to kind of plant into people's minds beliefs and ideas and quite possibly subvert such a thing. So I wasn't completely convinced that Bitcoin's going to, you know, save the world or make it that much. It'll make it better, but just like the internet, which has allowed us to communicate, it's allowing us to have this call. The internet can also be used as a tool for bad, you know, because nowadays the internet's used for censorship, and it's used for, there's so much censorship of information. And if the information that you're getting from the internet is incorrect, and also if they make it very hard to find the correct information, then you can kind of fall into this trap of dogma, and it becomes like a whole brand new religion all over again. So that can be some of the pitfalls of technology, including Bitcoin, by the way.
Well, of course, we have a situation right now, for example, where we've got Ukraine going on, and Russia has denied people access to Facebook and essentially most of the tools of the internet. And so they're subverting fair, free flow and relevant information, which is, you know, always a problem.
But actually, I would say that Facebook is not a free flow of information. And I would say that neither is Google.
No, and I just use that as an example, but I'm thinking more of just access to information.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I know what you mean, though, but I mean, essentially what a lot of people don't actually know is that Google controls about something like 90% of all of the internet searches through like mobile. And in fact, that there's only two search engines. I know we're segueing a little bit, but I will get back into what really got me into programming. This is kind of an important segue to give some context. Essentially that, they control all the information. So So there's only two search engines. A lot of people don't realize this. There's just Google and Bing, which is just Microsoft. All your other search engines like DuckDuckGo or whatever, they actually pull from DuckDuckGo, I think, pulls from Bing. StartPage, I'm not sure. I think Yahoo and StartPage probably pull from Bing. So a lot of these search engines, actually, they're not actually indexing anything. Okay, they're just utilizing the results from the other search engines, and right. which is just all Google and Microsoft. Which means that essentially a couple companies have control over all the information, and they do censor a lot, and they censor very aggressively, and they censor for political reasons all the time. Right. And it's outrageous. It's so bad. Like, these companies, the world would be better off if they were just shut down. Honestly. So in that case, yeah, I understand why Russia did that. But they're no better. Okay. Russia has their own search engine, which is Yandex. Okay. And I think China has Baidu. And there's one other, there's Gigablast, which is a tiny little company that's been indexing the internet for a long time. And they're one of the very few independent ones. There's a decentralized crawler as well called Yaesi, but not enough people use it to give it the information that it needs. And then there's the dark web, but they have all their indexes are just private lists of sites. So there's no way of easily navigating that at all. So yeah, there's very little access to free information like it was back in the day when Google was uncensored. Because when it was uncensored, you could just find everything, which right. you could argue is a bad thing because you can find things that are bad. But no, it's more important for it to be uncensored, because that's exactly why the freedom of speech was protected by the First Amendment.
Right.
And in fact, even Kennedy, right before he got killed, I think his last speech had something to do with that. And this is exactly what he said. He says, this is why the freedom of speech is protected by the First Amendment, because if you have censorship of the news by organizations, then you essentially lose all access to knowledge, you know, which is horrible. And so what we have is a modern day burning down of the Library of Alexandria, essentially, because we have companies that are controlling the information and completely destroying it. So with that said, and, you know, I mean, with it, when it comes to situations like Ukraine and United States and Russia and all that stuff, you have to understand that these are just large, powerful people who target citizens, whether or not it's United States started wars for no reason. Okay. And they never got sanctioned, you know, NATO joined in on the war. And in fact, I think even certain countries like France actually had sanctions against them for not going to war. What a joke is that? And so you have these countries that essentially have a carte blanche to like bomb whoever they feel like. And then when Russia starts doing it, they turn around and they have this international condemnation, which is fine. I mean, Russia shouldn't be going to war. I totally agree. I think war is disgusting. But at the same time, it strikes me as slightly hypocritical, because the United States is engaged in so many wars. I don't even think people have an accurate count of how many countries they've even bombed at this point. So I don't know why isn't everybody sanctioning and boycotting American products then? You know, they should, really, based on their track record. But it's true across all politicians. Essentially, the victims of war are always citizens. They're not other politicians. They're not heads of the military. Those people stay happily in their multi-million-dollar mansions while other people go and fight their battles, which is essentially how it's always been. And it's sad, you know, but people should learn to lay down their guns, all of them, every single military member, every single cop. They should just cut the shit and stop taking orders from tyrants. But since we can't guarantee that that'll happen, that's why we try to strike at the root of things. So one of the things that I'd always identified as the root of the problem is deception. And this is what got me excited about Bitcoin specifically. Okay, so I realized that because Bitcoin is electronic, an electronic account, which you can do pretty much anything with, unlike a bank, would they have their own rules. I was like, oh, wow, with Bitcoin, you know, you could make a joint account. And with that, you can make a contract which can't be broken. So what I realized is if both parties essentially make a promise, like I promise you I'm going to do something, could be to pay you for goods or services, you promise you're going to deliver the goods or services. What happens if both of us put our money in a joint account and we time that joint account to blow itself up? That might sound crazy, like why would you blow up money? But it's the equivalent of me and you putting our money in a safe, locking the safe. I have a key and you have a key. And in order to get in, we have to unlock it at the same time. Okay. And then we strap, you know, dynamite to it. We walk away and we say, okay, we'll be back in a week. You do your part, I do mine. And you do your part, I pay you. And if either of us are dissatisfied with the deal, we both lose. So I said, oh my God, this is the first time in history we've ever had a chance to make a deal, an agreement, that can be enforced without law. And that was astonishing to me. I was like, oh my, this is so important, because now there's a non-violent resolution to a contract. You see what I'm saying? All modern contracts are essentially resolved violently. And what I mean by that is behind every law, whether or not it be a parking ticket or jaywalking, doesn't matter, or whatever, it's actually enforced violently. Because if you don't pay that ticket, well, maybe they'll put a lien on something or whatever, and then that lien leads to, if you don't get off your property, then they'll actually attempt to take it by force. And if you don't accept the fact that they're going to take it by force, they will shoot you. It's the same thing if you're caught, you know, not stopping at a stop sign, cop pulls you over, you can't just drive away, okay? Because he'll shoot you, you know? So actually all laws are enforced through violence, and we need to be in a society that doesn't enforce law through violence. So essentially this was a way to have it enforced by the money itself, which allows two people to barter. And most importantly, that it's not enforced by an escrow agent, because most deals in society are enforced by escrow agents. For example, judges, lawyers, or just, you know, real estate escrow agent, doesn't matter. Essentially what they call a non-biased third party, but there's literally no such thing. Non-biased third party doesn't exist unless it's the heavens or something, okay? Like most humans do not have the moral capacity to properly judge a situation. And this is seen by our legal system, which is completely corrupt and wicked. Okay, like we see people getting thrown into jail without any evidence whatsoever for things that shouldn't even be crimes, victimless crimes. And it's sad. It's awful. It's the worst thing. So essentially the point is, and I guess I give another analogy for this. If you were accused of something you didn't do, okay, let's say you're accused of murder, but you didn't do it, okay? Would you trust 100 judges? Would you trust 1,000? How big does the jury have to be? Would you trust a jury of 10? Would you trust a jury of 20 if you presented your evidence? Probably the answer would be no, because why would you trust somebody else if they weren't there? You know, what if you were framed? What if the evidence actually doesn't look good for you, but it's actually false, you know? So, or what if the jury is just a bunch of fools? I mean, why would you put your fate in the hands of others, especially when the common person that they put on a jury typically is supposed to be uneducated of the law, actually, and they'll handpick them to be so. So, you know, it's outrageous. And I found this solution essentially to a big, big problem in society that had never been proposed before. So that's what caused me to develop BitHalo, which is what I am known for, and probably one of the main reasons people would recognize me on this podcast. And essentially that was the first contracting platform ever made for Bitcoin. So to answer your question, I got involved into programming because of that. And from there I was all self-taught. So from when I was in North Dakota, I was very motivated because I was already used to doing long hours. So I did about, I would say, the same thing. I was working almost 100-hour weeks. I was probably working 16 to 18 hours a day. I'd roll out of bed. I'd try to figure out how to code because I really didn't know how to code well enough yet. So I had to go learn Python. And instead of doing any practice programs, I just went straight and tried to make this program, you know? So at the same time as learning Python, I had to learn cryptography, I had to learn Bitcoin, I had to learn how to work with the transactions. And Bitcoin's very much like old school accounting, working with dollars. It's not like you just add 10 to your account and then magically you get 10 Bitcoins. It's not like that. You got to work with each transaction as if it was, you know, digital cash, and work with digital signatures and stuff like that. So it was a lot of learning. And I had to figure out how to do that all on my own. And there wasn't much support material at the time because it was the early days of Bitcoin. So it was about maybe 2013. So there wasn't that many resources online. And just with enough effort, you know, after about 3-4 months, I actually banged up the whole prototype myself. Interestingly enough, the reason why I actually had to do the coding myself and I couldn't pay anybody, but aside from the fact that it would be expensive, was... I'd always found to have trouble with outsourcers, specifically programmers. I mean, they pad their hours, they lag on their schedules. You have to kind of trust them almost blindly. I mean, if you think it's hard to find a good mechanic or a good doctor, good luck finding a good programmer, it's even worse. Okay. So to find really good and skilled people for that, that'll work, especially within your, you know, budget, was impossible. And that's why my mom told me, she said, was asking about it. I said, I don't know who I could find for this. She says, well, why don't you just do it yourself? And I sat there and I thought about it and I said, okay. Interestingly enough, when I did the work, I was actually in North Dakota, negative 50 below, you know, with the wind chill. I was living in a trailer at the time to save money. And so imagine I'm living in a trailer in that weather.
Yeah.
And I didn't just pick up and go. I had like maybe 9 space heaters. I had 1 space heater for my water line because I didn't park right over it, which was a mistake. And then I had 3 under the skirting. I had 3 inside. I had 1 small space heater to keep the ammonia on my fridge from freezing, which I didn't even know that was a thing, which was hilarious because that actually happened. Like my fridge froze, but that can happen because they put those on the outside of the trailer. So I actually needed a tiny little space heater for that. And that's in addition to propane. Now, granted, I was living quite comfortably with all that, but I had to siphon the electricity off of the lot next to me. Luckily, they were comping us on electricity, which they stopped doing later. But yeah, so I mean, it was brutal, and I had to do all that work. It was actually so hard that I ended up losing some weight, and I had neglected my health, and I realized, I have to nurse myself back to health. And so I called my parents and went out and visited them, and I said, hey, you know, you got to cook for me for like a month. And I just did whatever I had to put weight on at that point. I just grabbed some Ensure or whatever and had a bunch of meals and stuff,
so,
put all my weight back.
So one of the things that comes, one of the things that comes to mind is, what motivated you to do so much self-teaching of yourself? What was it that instilled that in you? Because clearly you're a very curious person. I think you've alluded to some of it, but you're a very curious person and you are not at all afraid to teach yourself and try things. How did you really get that way exactly? Was that from the chess, or where is that from?
It's a good question. I guess I mean, some of it has to obviously come directly from somebody's soul. They just have to be somebody who seeks knowledge, who seeks truth. Obviously that's part of it. Then the second part is going to be like, when you seek truth, you're going to question some of the things that you're taught. Like if the schools tell you something, you don't necessarily want to accept it blindly. A student would be in a class. I really can't stand how modern schools are run. For example, kids will just sit in a chair for 8 hours a day, listening to a teacher just literally lecture to them. And they essentially accept everything at face value, including the sciences, which is a huge mistake, because technically science, the root of science, is actually in replication. See, science isn't supposed to be a dictate or a mandate. Science isn't supposed, we're currently living under a scientific dictatorship, actually. It's totally autocratic and bad. It's no better than, you know, people are always getting angry about old religious fanaticism when we lived under religious fanatics. But actually, ironically, science can become a fanatical cult as well, especially because people don't actually check it. So we are under this illusion that people check all of our science properly. And in my research, because I wanted to make the world better, I ended up realizing that a lot of that's actually not the case. Most of our science is horribly flawed. In fact, kind of crazy, to be honest. People believe in, you know, relativity, which is essentially time travel. They believe in, you know, matter bending space. How do you bend space? It's like nothing. There's nothing there. How do you bend it? So, I mean, there's just, people don't even ask like fundamental questions. And so when I started to do that, I started to end up really cherishing the ability to do research. And that's kind of how I got involved into self-teaching, which is, I realized, and there's actually old adages to this, even in, you know, for example, in the Bible, they'll say, you know, prove all things. But it was on all the religions. People understood that in order to properly understand a concept, you have to be able to repeat it. And science is not really effective unless I can sit down with tools, you know, and check the information. You know what I mean? So I think when you have that amount of rigor in your approach to anything, let it be business, you know, of course, a scientific field, could even be programming. Essentially, you have to learn to do it yourself. And if you don't learn to do it yourself, you're going to rely on somebody else to do it for you. And that's even more dangerous in programming, where you're working with other people's money. Like, do I really want to be responsible for other people losing money because somebody that I hired didn't do the job properly? I mean, that's a nightmare. If I don't have the ability to audit my own code, then I'm good for nothing. I mean, how am I going to be able to put so much of other people's money on the line when you're dealing with financial systems? And that's a huge difference from when you're working in Bitcoin versus any other field. Because, yeah, granted, you're working in another field, like you're flipping burgers, you screw up. Okay, nobody's life's on the line. Okay, you just, you fix it and you move on. But that's not the case with financial systems. With financial systems, if you screw up, you could be looking at people losing millions, if not hundreds of millions, in fact, billions, which has happened many times in the Bitcoin industry because of absolute negligence. It has to do with lack of auditing, lack of self-teaching, lack of rigor, lack of discipline to a field which is actually scientific. People don't see the cryptography industry as a scientific field because they assume that programs just work. They just assume apps just work. You get in the car and it just goes, but that's not the case. The amount of work that goes into making the car go, that making the app work, in fact, it requires quite a bit of ingenuity. And there's no end to which a person can self-teach, which also would bring us back to humility, because if you want to be able to actually excel in anything, you have to have that, because a lot of the times you're going to have to take all the notions that you have, tear them down, throw them out, and try to replace them with something better, regardless of what the modern dogma is. You could, like I said, you could have the whole world believing things one way, but if they don't properly question it, that's their problem. And if one person comes in and starts to question it, true, they might not get the media attention, they might not get the traction, but they still might be right. And that's the thing. Truth is objective, thank God, because of that, we have the ability to check for ourselves. And so self-teaching is absolutely critical. And I think that if anything was to be taught in schools, that should be the first thing, which is teaching children how to research, teaching them how to question, teaching them how to be skeptics. And teaching, of course, I think some strong spiritual concepts about how to truly care about truth and how to pursue it.
So that gets back to something that a couple of things that you talked about and comments that you made that I want to go back to. One, let's talk about science a little bit. You're right about being able to replicate. So Einstein created the theory of relativity, general and specific relativity. But again, I think that with people like him, with people who've created scientific theories, they're trying to create explanations for what they see. And they have created theories that explain observations that they've seen. You said relativity is about time travel. Well, relativity is more about the speed of light, if it is a constant, which the theory currently says that it is, but it's also about what information you get as you are traveling less than the speed of light and what happens to you when you travel faster than the speed of light. We also know, physicists also will tell you, that the expectation is that sometime there will be a theory that will come along that will explain more of what we understand today. It's like classical mechanics moved into quantum mechanics and relativity, which will go into something else. But I think that people are trying to find explanations for the observations that they make. Well, and unfortunately, some of it they can't replicate, because they can only see what they can see. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, so yeah, this is a, if you don't, I mean, this is a real can of worms.
It is.
The subject, and it may be outside of the scope of this podcast, but I'd be happy to talk about it. Essentially, it's amazing how many assumptions are made in terms of our scientific rigor in regards to these fields, which are purely theoretical.
Oh, I agree.
Relativity,
by the way, I agree.
Relativity is not a proven concept at all.
It's a theory.
Neither is quantum mechanics. They're theoretical, and in fact, I would argue that they're even potentially lies, even malicious ones. And I can explain a little bit as to why. So first of all, quantum mechanics was developed in response to things like the double slit experiment, which essentially debunked the idea of, for example, the electron molecule, because previous beliefs about physics, especially with chemistry, was to consider that like things like light was actually the behavior of a gas or a fluid, which they called the ether. So they felt that how do you have a wave, without resistance. You know, you can't have a wave without resistance. Waves happen because there's pressure, and pressure is trying to equalize. Essentially, if you have a glass of water, you stir it, you get a wave. But how do you have a wave or an oscillating wave of light without it moving through any medium? And they constantly abstract these things, and they create these really bizarre abstractions of the mind, as if light and gravity are just all in this other world that doesn't exist in our main physical world. But I hate to break it to them. Stuff is stuff. You can't have energy without it being something. It's got to be something. So therefore,
which gets back to the comment that, and I appreciate what you say, but which gets back to the whole point of they're not explaining everything yet. And there is a lot more that we don't understand.
I'm arguing that it actually is explainable. It's very explainable. And it's actually something that can be properly physically modeled. And in fact, we had scientists before our current scientists that already had very good models for this. Not perfect, but good. For example, Tesla, Heaviside, Maxwell, doesn't matter who you bring up, any of these major scientists, Einsteinian stuff, they actually all believed in the ether. So they believed that light was the movement of fluid, which would mean that they did not believe in atomic theory. Okay, so the major flaw in atomic theory is not so much with the proton, the model of a proton, which is fine. You know, you could argue a proton's a shell that could fill and release fluid or something along these lines. But an electron, you see, the issue was having one electron for each proton. So they essentially say that the atom is essentially empty. It's completely empty space. And then there's just a single electron. That model should have gone away. Tesla couldn't stand it. He thought it was crazy. He thought it was like, what you call it? You know, the emperor has no clothes. You ever heard that story? So I mean, kind of like the emperor has no clothes. Essentially, there's all these people believing in these, you know, strange theories is actually complete nonsense. The idea is that how can an atom be truly empty? You have the movement of matter, okay, and so you have to have the most subtle matter. So essentially, when you have the movement of electrons, you know, it should be full. You know, atoms shouldn't be empty; they should be mostly full. And that would better describe light. For example, light behaves like a wave. It doesn't behave like a particle. Okay, it never did. And in fact, when you had things like the double slit experiment, it proved that light was a wave. Unequivocally, completely proved that light is a wave. The debate should have been over. But what happened was, and this has to do with introspection, our modern scientists had so much arrogance that they couldn't admit that perhaps the model of the electron and atomic theory was wrong. So because they couldn't admit it, they decided to create whatever math they could. It didn't matter if the electron had to travel through time, like Feynman proposed. It didn't matter if the electron's bumping into possible versions of itself and creating wave-like patterns through different timelines. I mean, these people are crazy. They'll do anything to justify the theory of the electron to make it seem like a wave without it being a wave. But if you want it to be a wave, I have a better idea. Nix the idea of the electron and just say that the atom is full. It's filled. It's filled with fluid of subtle fluids moving in and out of it. It's just the changing of pressure and stuff like that. And you get a much better model for our modern physics than what we used to have, or what we have currently. Sorry, I'm saying what we had prior to this was actually a better model. And in fact, if we had applied it even today to modern computer models, I think we would find it all to be much, much better. I think it'd explain our physics better. I think it'd explain our chemistry better. And so essentially it's just a misunderstanding of the behavior of solids, liquids, and gases, and to the dismissal of the fact that they can be much, much more subtle than the hard matter, like, you know, the photons and the elements and stuff like that. And essentially underestimating the fact that, you know, that we had a model, we had an answer for it. We believed that these things were waves because they were the movement of mediums. They were the movement of fluids. You know, that when you see light, you're essentially looking at the movement of a gaseous kind of fluid almost, because when the fluid's disturbed, just like, you know, the waves in the ocean, you know, a wave pattern is generated because there's collision and there's competing for space and pressure. And so then when you have collision, then you have a wave pattern. And when you have a wave pattern, you know, you can interpret it and all this other stuff. So it makes perfect sense. It fits within our physics. But if you look at the modern physics, actually, they literally say that, like, light will come from nowhere. The electron produces the light and then it just vanishes. Like they just make things up. The quantum theories, and I'll probably get some flack for saying all this, but essentially the quantum theories rely on things like time travel. But you got to also have to look at it like this, like time travel or adding any type of, you know, as you're, for example, as your speed increases, you approach the speed of light, you know, then all of a sudden time slows down, which is just a real sad theory in my opinion, because what it's basically essentially saying is mathematically, it's saying something mathematically. It's saying, if my experiments don't match the results, then I will travel backwards in time and I will fix them. Essentially, it's the equivalent of wanting to travel back in time and go ahead and fix errors in your results. But you see, science is not about taking theories and trying to force everything into your theory. Science is about measurement, and that's it. You look out, you measure, you report. You measure, you report. You don't start inventing ideas about time travel just because, you know, a certain experiment doesn't quite fit your model. There's always a very logical explanation as to why these things are the way they are. One easy one would just be that light's not a constant. You know, and light isn't really a constant anyway, because the medium in which you see light, if it was dependent upon the movement of a gas or a fluid, you know, like the ether, then in the medium in which you would see it, you know, that would make sense that it would change depending on what it passes through. For example, when you have light passing through water, okay, it slows down because there's increased refraction. When you have light passing through a gas, it may be different. Light does in fact vary in speed quite a bit based on the medium that it's passing through, because it's a misunderstanding when you look at light that they think light is the movement of photons, when actually light's just simply could be just the medium of a gaseous kind of you know, body, kind of like the ether. Right. There was a belief that the ether was actually debunked, but actually that was false. There's like, I think it was there was the Michelson-Morley experiment, and there was also the Sagnac experiment. And I believe the one of them caused a lot more problems for them than the other, because one of them was just looking for ether drag, but the other one was looking for actually just in general, just the idea that the ether was there. And I think they had more, don't quote me on this, I have to double check, but I think it was the Sagnac experiment which caused them so many problems. So you can see, even when you look it up, all the patchwork that they had to do. And then, of course, they had to invoke relativity again, I think, in order to deal with these problems, because they couldn't fit it into their model, because their model was that weak.
But let me ask a couple.
Ironically, the simpler model is, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go so far down this, but it's such an interesting topic, because people actually know about it. Yeah. But this model essentially is the movement. It's basically the behavior of fluid dynamics, which is something we already understand. It makes sense. We can apply it. We can model it. We can use it in computers. We don't have to go with all these fantastical quantum mechanic, you know, type theories. And this is just an example of kind of some of this stuff, you know.
Let me ask you another question that I'm really curious about. You made the comment earlier, and I think that there's probably some merit to it, that a lot of people don't grow up or are very moral, and we don't have the moralities and so on that we really ought to have. If I understood you right, my question is, how do we teach that? How do we get people back into a moral or a more ethical and a moral compass kind of a track?
Well, you know, they always say a good teacher is a good student.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think that once parents and schools and institutions and people start to understand how far they've fallen, I think that'll be a very important moment of redemption, because then they'll realize that things are getting out of hand, which they are already. I mean, we can see all over the world, things are really out of hand, and they've been so for a while, but it seems that each generation, it seems to get worse. We'd mentioned earlier, about laws, you know, I told you how we have, you know, essentially millions of laws, but that can't possibly be right, because that can't follow a moral compass. How can you expect somebody to be beholden to a million laws? You know, how does even a person know what all the laws actually are? In fact, quite frequently, the judge doesn't even know what the law is. Lawyers have to go to school for 10 years or however, 5, 10 years to just figure out what the law is. Heck, even my real estate, when I had to study for my real estate license, I had like 10 books, you know, which were super thick, like 400 or 500 pages each, just to teach me the law. I mean, this is crazy, in my opinion, because the truth of the matter is actually morality is quite simple. And you know, you don't kill, you don't cheat, right? You don't lie to people. You don't force anybody to do anything. You know, you don't force them to do your bidding. I mean, how hard is it? I mean, there's not that many things. Interestingly enough, lying is one of the least criminalized concepts. Excuse me. It's criminalized when there's financial loss sometimes, but tends to be a slap on the wrist when you have large scale fraud in the banking system and stuff that costs people billions of dollars. You don't see the heads of Chase or Goldman Sachs going to jail. They pay a fine and they move on. If you see pharmaceutical companies knowingly giving people things that are going to kill them, like drugs that should have been recalled or whatever, you don't see them going to jail. They get a slap on the wrist and they move on. And in fact, they lobby for legal immunity. So this just goes to show you how nonsensical the law is and how immoral the law actually is. And actually, I find that each year the law moves further and further away from morality, becoming completely immoral, to where morality ends up being breaking the law. Actually, there's a saying that says, when freedom is outlawed, only outlaws will be free. So it's interesting to look at it from that perspective. And of course, what I'm arguing is not to do anything bad. Actually, ironically, I'm arguing to do things that are good. But that's the thing, like, just because something is legal, in fact, could mean that it's actually a bad thing. You know, like, there's a lot of legalized forms of atrocities. For example, like I told you, the immunities that some of the drug companies get for things that they do to people knowingly, by the way. So, you know, so I mean, I think when you look at it from that perspective, personally, I'm a minimalist. I think that the amount of laws that a government or society should have should fit on a few sheets of paper. You know, like if I can read the law in a single evening, then it's probably acceptable. But if it takes me 10 years of schooling to figure out what the law is, then I think there's a big problem with the law. And I think it has a big problem with the way in which children are taught and raised. And I think that they should be taught to understand basically the root concepts of what morality actually is all about.
Good. Let me ask you another question, if I could. I got two more that I can think of, and then we'll have been going for a while. So this is certainly a lot of fun. What's the future of BitDay and BitHalo? Where do you see all of that going?
Yeah. So, I mean, I know we probably skipped that part a little bit, because basically from BitHalo, I made the software that made the unbreakable contracts, which still runs. We still have a lot of users. And then from there, I was taken into a project called BitBay. And then that project, actually, the founders had, it was actually kind of, you know, if you say in your show, kind of like overcoming all odds, the founders had essentially left, and, you know, they tried to hurt all the original people who had invested. Actually, I was only hired on the job as a programmer, essentially from taking my software BitHalo and like giving it to them. But because they had left the project high and dry, I decided to take over the project. So actually, it wasn't theoretically my project. But because I saw what happened, I said, well, no, I have to do something about this. And so, yeah, I guess you could argue maybe my overdeveloped sense of justice or something. I decided to go in and take care of it. And so I spent a few years, and then about 2018, 2019, it had totally exploded, and it had gone from being essentially worthless to being worth about $500 million. And that was great. And it was a great success story, although I didn't really capitalize much. And I did a little bit, but not much. And unfortunately, that kind of hurt the project, ironically, because sometimes you got to put some money in the bank so that you can go fund your own project, you know? And I was probably way too focused on my, you know, goals of getting all my work done and making sure I had everything coded. But that's okay. So what had happened then is we were a little short on resources, and we weren't able to incorporate to the exchanges the way that we wanted to. So a lot of the central exchanges, we had a major change in the BitBay project, which was a currency. It's like an alternative currency to Bitcoin. And I had coded in this change, actually, which was meant to protect investors, which was that we could control the supply, essentially. So it's actually the only coin in the world that can do it. And so we have this ability to control the supply by having inflation and deflation happen. So when deflation happens, essentially a user's funds are moved into what's called like reserve. And when it's moved into reserve, then they still have access to the funds, but the funds move slower. So think of it like an automatic savings account. Whereas, as opposed to like a bank that imposes a negative interest rate, you know, where they're essentially just taking your money, in this case, nobody actually takes your money. You get the money placed into your own account in reserve. And then, you know, when inflation happens, it gets released to you again. So think of it kind of almost like a decentralized reserve bank, and it's really effective. Unfortunately, that change affected how we were able to operate with exchanges, and we got somewhat censored from this, and unrightfully so, because it was really, really, really cutting edge technology, and it's actually the only coin in the world that does it. So that's it's cool, but everybody was excited about it, but we got kind of screwed over the past year and a half or so because we ended up losing all of our exchanges. So the future of it is that we're going to be putting BitBay on all the decentralized exchanges, because the decentralized exchanges are ownerless, permissionless. We don't really have to ask anybody to add it. I just have to do the work and make sure that the code works with our, you know, dynamic supply that kind of moves up and down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the history of that. And yeah, of course, I'd be more than happy to speak more about it with you on a later date if you like. But essentially, yeah, that's the future of it. So once we get them on the decentralized exchanges, all of a sudden some of the liquidity can start moving back into the project, and you know, we breathe life into it again, and all's well that ends well. BitHalo is just BitHalo though, the one that makes the unbreakable contracts. Actually, they both do it. They both make unbreakable contracts. BitHalo works with Bitcoin. Essentially, really, the only thing for that is maybe eventually we'll build support for like Ethereum or some of the other coins, possibly, so that they can also take advantage of it. But for the in the meantime, you know, it's free software to use. You know, I don't make anything. I don't make any money when people use it. It's open source software. So, you know, I mean, that's the whole idea, is that, of being an open source dev, and, you know, thank God for Bitcoin's given us all open source developers an opportunity to also kind of get involved in a project and even make some money doing so without having to rely on on people to actually pay you, because essentially if we're involved with the cryptocurrency industry, you know, obviously it's a nascent industry and it's been growing, so we make money on our own anyway. So that's a good thing. And it's given open source developers a lot of interesting ways to make money without actually really charging users up front. You know what I mean?
But with BitHalo,
I don't even make money on the escrows. I just want to clarify that.
But the concept is really fascinating, and it's always good to think about ways to have a truly unbreakable contract. And I hope it catches on more, because it makes perfect sense. It's easy in a sense. It requires a moral perspective, which we've talked about a lot, but still it's an easy and a relevant thing to think about. Let me ask you one final question, because we've been talking for a while, and it's got to be dinner time for you, and we're getting that way with us as well. What kind of advice, what would you suggest to entrepreneurs? You know, there are a lot of people who want to have the entrepreneurial spirit. There are a lot of people who think they ought to be able to have the entrepreneurial spirit and be entrepreneurs, but they don't know how to do it. What do you advise people, or what kind of advice do you have to give people about how to be entrepreneurs, and for existing people who have an entrepreneurial spirit, how can they kind of reinforce that and make it even stronger?
Well, I think one thing is to try to see what other people aren't doing, you know, because if you see what other people aren't doing, you have a chance to carve out a niche for yourself. Furthermore, I think another thing is also to set aside for a moment thinking so much about the money, and think more about how you can actually reach people. Because at the end of the day, you're really, the success of a platform comes from its liquidity and movement. Once a platform is moving, it has life in it. Take, for example, Google, or YouTube. When YouTube first started, you know, they didn't charge anything. They didn't even have advertising, for that matter.
Right.
So how did a platform that went from making nothing becoming one of the most powerful platforms in the world, which is just astonishing. So it comes from this idea that your users essentially are what give you value. And nobody really likes being marketed to, you know. I mean, I can't even remember the last time I've responded to an ad. Sometimes seeing ads make me not even want to buy the thing. So I think that also people should be looking into softer forms of advertising. Advertising, you know, really essentially something along the lines of, like, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Right.
You know what I mean? But if you're working to be an entrepreneur just for money as a means to an end, I don't know. It's just not my cup of tea. I don't really have as as effective advice for people like that. Except for
I would think, though, that the entrepreneurial spirit really isn't that. I think that the, yeah, you people want to make money and all that, but I would hope that people who truly are entrepreneurial in nature have more reasons than just making money.
Well, I think they do. I think when they, I think even the greedy ones tend to have something behind it. Because if you really unearth why is it that they love running businesses, eventually they're gonna boil down to the fact that they want to create something in the world. You know, they like working with things, they like creating things, they like having something that's operating and functioning under them. So I think that they do like the idea of kind of breathing life into a baby or a business, so to speak. And always they have to remember about the amount of work. Essentially, I mean, it really is like what you put into it is what you will get out of it. The harder you work, the more you'll get out of it. And also the more you're willing to kind of check every corner. You know, it's like when you follow, I guess you could say a formula, you might be able to make some money following the formula, actually. But you have to, before you go ahead and start understanding those things, you need to also kind of unearth every little rock and turn over every rock in every corner and be a skeptic and try to kind of see what it is that you have and haven't tried and how much work it's going to take you. And of course, then there's the most important thing, which is your bottom line, because essentially anything that you do is going to affect your bottom line and how much time you're spending. You know, I mean, right. Even taking a phone call, going on a podcast, you know, go anything. I mean, you know, how long you spend eating breakfast or how long you're stuck in traffic. Everything essentially affects your bottom line. You know, essentially this is why people outsource. This is why people, you know, buy things in bulk from China or other things like that, because they look at their bottom line and they know that essentially they're getting a project done for X and they're going to sell it for, you know, four or five times that or whatever, you know what I mean? So I think that those are some of the things. And also, lastly, then sometimes it takes a little bit of a sacrifice. Some businesses aren't successful for a while and people may end up feeling like failures because they may have run two or three businesses and they didn't work. I mean, I'm not a fan of working with other people's money. So I'm not really a fan of working with loans. I prefer working with cash or free time. So either buy yourself some free time or get more cash. You know, but everybody has their own way of looking at it. I'm sure that a lot of people like working with loans. Or invest your money. Not my cup of tea. But regardless of how they structure it, I mean, they're gonna have to kind of know that it's not necessarily going to be guaranteed to be a success right out the gate. And that's especially true for the restaurant industry. It takes time to build traction. A lot of restaurants won't even make money in their first year. And so there also has to be the concept of sacrifice and overhead. Because obviously, if you're running a business, you're gonna have a certain amount of things that you're gonna have to sacrifice, albeit free time or profits, or you might even have to do things to impress your consumers and your clients. You might have to do things to make people really feel at home with your business, to enjoy being around you, you know, enjoy working with your business, enjoy going to your whatever it is, online business, web page, you know, it doesn't matter, essentially. And and once you create that environment for people, then I think eventually they'll come. Of course, obviously everything still boils down to liquidity and marketing. I mean, essentially, if you have the marketing and if you have the money, you can make anything work, but you still have to have a quality product.
I would say that probably the most important thing I've heard you say from an entrepreneurial standpoint is that any good teacher is also a good student. And I think anyone who is going to be an entrepreneur needs to not think that they have all the answers and be really curious to learn more. One of the shows that we watch is a show called Restaurant Impossible with Robert Irvine. And Robert Irvine is a guy who goes to restaurants that are failing. He sees what doesn't work about them and he helps get the restaurants somewhat back on track. But clearly he's a guy who is incredibly curious. It isn't just, I'm going to show you because I'm the expert. It is, he really makes
like
it
Gordon
very,
Ramsay.
Oh, not at all like Gordon Ramsay's image. Although I know someone who knows Gordon Ramsay and they actually say that's more image than anything. But still, Robert.
I'm sure he's a really nice. I'm sure he's a really nice guy.
No, I understand.
He's got his show and attracts viewers. But
Robert really looks at people and has learned to read people and helps the people in the restaurants that he goes to understand the things that would enhance what they do. And most of the real basic stuff that he gets to are how people interact with people and how people deal with people and how people view other people, namely how the owner of the restaurant works with the team, how to create a team. And he gets people to think generally in a completely different way than probably they really did before. And that's what's very fascinating about what he does, because it really is all about deciding that you want to be a student, not just the teacher who's the expert on what you do, but to be a student and be willing to learn more things and then put those into practice, which I think is really cool of what he does.
Well, that's also kind of why, like, it's like when I mentioned earlier, one of the most important skills that I'd probably learned was research. Because once I learned to kind of research and almost have an embarrassing amount of candor and aggressiveness to try to find the truth behind something, you know.
Right.
So I guess it's kind of why I'm capable of, if you pick up a subject, you know, if you want to talk about physics, I'm more than capable of doing it because I actually did a lot of, you know, unearthing over and over again, trying to really fully understand the truth behind things. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's a hard pill to swallow, honestly, because you have to do a lot of research and you have to reject a lot of research. I mean, 99% of the stuff that I read, I end up having to reject, but there's good reasons for it. And you can justify those reasons once you start having a really proper foundation and framework for explaining it and articulating it. You know what I mean? So and that only comes with hard work, and that comes with research. And I, of course, my research is never done. It's never finished. I'm not coming from a position of, where I'm going to claim I have this ultimate objectivity, which I don't feel. I feel that what's key is in the search for truth. And I think when you find something that you really, truly think is valuable, you know, you share it. So that's what it gives me a passion to share it, which is why I share it with hopefully other people. They'll go check, they'll compare it with their notes, and then they'll accept it or reject it. And they may come back to it later when they find they hit a few more dead ends, and it may take some people longer than others. And I think the ones that'll get around to it faster are the people who get really excited about trying to find out and essentially learn and attack it, trying to find out what the truth actually is about a lot of these things.
Because
really,
they
always end up meeting and.
The other side of that is that you could have discussions with people, and because you're a curious individual, and we'll kind of have to wrap up with this, but you are the kind of individual that it might be that somebody will say something or some other thought will come into your head that may completely change your position on whether it's physics or whatever, maybe not, but the point is you're open. And that's the most important thing that I think any of us can ever adopt as an attribute in our lives, is to be open and curious and be willing to listen and evaluate. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I've had to do it many times, you know, I've had to take the framework that I thought that I had and throw it out. And that's why I'm always happy to have like a discussion and to try to go over all the points. And it's always interesting when, especially above all things, actually enjoyed talking to experts about it, because what I ended up finding out is quite frequently when I bring up some of my ideas, especially the controversial ones, to experts, they actually sit there, they pause, they think about it, and then they're like, shit, I never even looked at it that way before.
And actually, you'd
be surprised how often they don't actually come back to me and, you know, throw their degrees in my face and all that other stuff. And actually, they are interested, because they too are looking for cutting edge ideas. You know what I mean? So, and of course, like I always say, you know, hey, if you've got something to knock down, you know, this concept, please, you know, I want to know, because that'll help me understand, you know, better. But yeah, I mean, what I've found is the pattern of most research I've done has been essentially the opposite of what society tells us, which is unfortunate, but true. So, you know, I find that typically when I see that something's become a dogmatic kind of mainstream thing in society, at least nowadays, it's always been kind of corrupted. And I think that has a lot to do with money and power and other things like that. And you'd be surprised how many industries money and power gets their hands into.
No, I don't think I would.
Especially the science fields.
I'm not sure that I would, but I hear you. Well, we're going
to
have
rhetorical.
I know what you're saying. Well, you know, if people want to reach out to you and maybe get in touch with you or have ideas to share, how can they do that?
Yeah, by all means. I mean, I'm available at my email. I don't know if do you post things on the show, like in the notes or something like that?
I'll be glad to. Sure. That's why I'm asking what you'd like me to put in.
Well, yeah. So you can post my email in the notes, and they can feel free to send.
Why don't you say what that is?
If they have a question. Well, why don't you say it anyway, actually.
Yeah, but why don't you say it because podcast is audio, so a lot of people won't be sitting where they can look at notes.
Well, it's dzimbeck@gmail.com. So just like my first name and my first initial.
D-Z-I-M-B-E-C-K.
D-I-M-B-E-C-K, yeah. So of course they could always look up BitHalo or anything like that, and they could find, you know, my name, and then, you know, basically it's dzimbeck@gmail.com. So and if they want to contact me,
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I found you through LinkedIn.
Right.
Yeah,
we found each other through LinkedIn. So. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, of course they could get me on there, but I don't use LinkedIn as much. So
no. Yeah. But they can reach you. I hope people will reach out. This has definitely been intriguing, and I will tell you that I have found this very stimulating and do want to continue the discussions and talk some more. So we can do more of this. But I really appreciate you coming on the show and chatting with us for all this time.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Thanks for taking interest. And you're obviously a very, very interesting person yourself. So it's always nice, you know, to meet somebody like that. And I appreciate it. And I really think what you're doing is very cool. And I like how you really. I feel like the function of your podcast is really to give inspiration to other people. So hopefully I've been an assistance to that. And I mean, I can only share the path that I walked. You know
exactly
what I mean?
Right.
I can't tell any people. I can only say, well, if they say, how did you do it? I said, well, I just put one foot in front of the other, you know, left foot, right foot. And then I ended up here. And so I share that experience. And if that resonates with somebody, then great. And I hope so. And I hope it can motivate people, because obviously motivation has to come from within. It's got to come from within. And so if somebody hears something that helps motivate them, then it must have meant that the motivation was really there inside of them all along. You know,
and they were looking
at the end
for
of the day, they're the ones making the decision. You know what I mean?
I do. Well, David, thank you very much for being here. And again, people can reach out to David Zimbeck at dzimbeck@gmail.com or find BitHalo and BitDay, and I hope people will reach out to you, and I guarantee you we will chat some more, and we will do another one of these, because there's so many topics that we can go into. But I hope that all of you know that you listening out there have enjoyed this. It definitely has been stimulating, far free ranging, and that's as fun as it gets. So thanks for listening. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can do so by sending me an email regarding the podcast at michaelhi@accessibe.com. You can also visit our podcast page, which is www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Tell other people about us and encourage them to listen and learn something new and become inspired by it. And of course, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening to this podcast. We hope you'll take the time to rate and come back again next week for another edition of Unstoppable Mindset. And we'll have some more fun, and we'll find somebody else interesting to talk with. David, thanks again.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much.
To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.